Well, Hill, in the third hour of Issues, Etc., we're going to deal with two different subjects. On this day, the church remembers St. Peter and St. Paul together. Although, you know, if you ask many Bible scholars, they'll tell you that Peter and Paul were not together, that Peter and Paul represented two different schools of early Christianity that competed for the truth, and then one of them won out. And that would be the school of Paul. Is that true? I mean, there is that very famous account recounted by Paul and then hinted at in both Galatians and in the book of Acts, where Paul and Peter run afoul of one another over an issue of the keeping of the law and that whole issue vis-a-vis the Gentiles. We're going to talk about that and many other things about Peter and Paul here in the last hour of the program. Dr. Peter Scare joins us here in just a moment for that conversation. Wesley Smith is waiting in the wings in the next 25 minutes. That is the last 25 minutes of the program. We're going to discuss with him religion, science, and stem cell research. Wesley Smith from the Discovery Institute and a regular guest here on the program in the last 25 minutes. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Those are our phone numbers if you have a question or a comment on Peter and Paul here for the next 20 minutes or so. Dr. Peter Scare is Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and a regular guest. Dr. Scare, welcome back.
Great to be here, Todd.
Let's clear this up. Were Peter and Paul representatives of two different and competing schools of Christianity in the early church? Of the two, Paul's school won, as so many scholars will contend.
Well, you know, I'm not complete. Of course, it's not true. That's overblown. But I do think it's a wonderful day that we can celebrate Peter and Paul together. And these are the two great figures of the early church. And I think the early church made a conscious decision to put them together as a reminder that their teaching cannot be split apart. And in one sense, I suppose they are towering figures in the New Testament. And they have many similarities, I suppose, and differences as well. Peter represents the 12. He was with Jesus for 3 years. He was really the leader of the 12. And he sat at the seminary for 3 years with Jesus. He was a great and bold leader. And Paul represents an outside tradition. Jesus, of course, appeared to Paul on the road to Damascus after his resurrection. And at that time, Paul became an apostle out of the blue, like a lightning bolt. And while Paul was a great leader, it was great standing before the crowd, Paul was a great intellectual and a great theologian of the early church. And Luke makes it a point in the book of Acts to note their similarities. They had great differences, but they had great similarities. One was a love for the gospel, a love for Jesus Christ. And also, Luke wants to say, let us know, reaching out to the Gentiles. Peter is the gospel, is the preacher to the Jews, and Paul is to the Gentiles. Well, the first commission to the Gentiles was to Peter and to the 12 apostles. And that's the same commission that Paul has. So I think it is overblown to say that there are two different theologies. That's not the case, or two different competing schools. Did they ever get into skirmishes with each other? Were there two big personalities in the same room? Oh, sure, I bet that's the case. I don't see how it could not be the case. But they were working together for the sake of the gospel.
So when Paul tells us that Peter extended to him the right hand of fellowship after having checked out his gospel, that is the message that Paul was preaching, we should take very seriously that these two men preached precisely the same Christ, the same salvation.
Oh, absolutely. And Paul makes there are some people evidently in Galatia, the churches that Paul's preaching into in Galatia, people were trying to pit Paul and Peter against each other. You know, that always happens when you have two great figures. One person says, you know, well, of course, you're not as great as Peter. But Paul says no. He met Peter, and he told Peter what he was preaching. And Peter could do nothing to add to Paul's gospel and nothing to detract from it, but he recognized that Paul was, in fact, preaching the same gospel. And when he gave him the right hand of fellowship, it's as if to say, you know what? I didn't know you before, but now I recognize we are members of the same church. We believe the same thing. We have the same doctrine. And it's this kind of spirit of working together that you see in Acts 15, for instance, in the gospel to the Gentiles. It's when Paul is preaching to the Gentiles and he's causing kind of a stir in Jerusalem, saying, you know, is what Paul doing radical? It's Peter who's the first one who stands up and says, you know, we had a difficulty following the Old Testament laws, and now we want the Gentiles to follow them as well. So Peter becomes Paul's big advocate, the big advocate for Paul's Gentile ministry. So you do see them working together.
Now, there's one little curious passage that I want you to deal with, and then we'll get into both of these men in particular, and that is where Peter writes, in a very little-known passage in one of his epistles, about Paul's writings. And he does two things. He calls them Scripture, on par with all Scripture. And he says they're sometimes hard to understand. What is Peter saying there of Paul's writings?
Well, I mean, if you've read Paul's letters, Paul's an intellectual. They're different kinds of people. And you know, the church takes different kinds. I think people have to recognize that when you look at the New Testament, you're looking at great titans, great theologians, but they're different. And Paul is kind of Peter's kind of a bold speaker. You know what he's saying. Paul is the one, Paul has complicated arguments. When I read, I have the chance to teach some of these things. It's a great blessing to do it. And I teach Romans regularly, and this summer I have the chance to teach Galatians. And we get to passages, and I throw up my hands in the air sometimes. I'm saying, what exactly is Paul trying to say? And it's fascinating doing. It's wonderful reading Paul, but it's not for the faint of heart to read Paul. It takes work. Intellectually, he's got a lot of firepower, and he's the great advocate for the faith. He's the kind of guy you want on your side. If you were on trial, you would want Paul to be your lawyer. He's a smart guy, and that means when you read his letters, you know, this is. Some of it's beautiful and you can understand readily, but a lot of it, it's not kid stuff. There's a lot there to chew on, and I think that's what he's talking about.
Now, as to Peter, now I've tried reading Peter's epistles too, and the Greek there is very lofty. It may be because Peter himself was no small intellect either. But what do you make of this picture of Peter and of the other disciples as simple, basically uneducated rubes from the backwoods? They were just simple, uneducated fishermen. What do you make of that characterization when it comes to Peter in particular?
Yeah, I don't think that can hold. I do think that Peter, though, is, you know, there's a list of gifts that Paul has. There are different gifts which we have. Some are prophets, some are teachers, some are evangelists, some are administrators. Now, these are not different offices within the church, but, you know, as pastors, some of us are better teachers. You teach on the radio on a regular way, and that's one of the gifts that you have as a pastor. Peter definitely had the gift, I think, of running the show. He was the kind of guy who could make things work. And in some churches, they have bishops. You know, Peter fits the role of the bishop. He's able to make things go and work people together. When you look at 1 Peter and 2 Peter, I don't know whether Peter, you know, wrote that himself or whether he had quote-unquote help. That's to say, when a president of a synod writes a letter to the churches, oftentimes he'll have a court theologian or something like that who kind of helps them. But when you see Peter's brilliance, look on the day of Pentecost, and inspired by the Holy Spirit, of course, but Peter gives a wonderful exposition of the Old Testament, merely, you know, 50 days after Jesus Christ has died and risen from the dead, and he gives a beautiful exposition of the Old Testament. He's a wonderful theologian, and he's able to. It seems like he's speaking like this in this way off the cuff. So he is a very smart person. And when Jesus chose the 12, these are not rubes. You know, Matthew the tax collector, Peter, James, and John, they may have been fishermen, but this doesn't mean simply that they were menial laborers, but they were businessmen. And, you know, the truth is in the proof is in the writing. Whether you look at John, who was a fisherman, who was certainly a brilliant and, you know, deep person, or Peter, who was brilliant and probably Peter's greatest gift was an oratory. He was a great speaker, and it comes out in the book of Acts. So, these were not simple peasant or illiterate folks.
And by the same token, Paul himself admits not to be a great rhetorician, not to be a great speaker.
Yeah, but you know, I don't believe him. That's one of the rhetorician's greatest ploys. I know that whenever I give a speech, I can't stand it when the person gives me a glowing introduction saying, you know, you're going to be wowed, you're going to be moved by the Spirit, you're going to be impressed, and it's too hard to match up to it. It's much better to say, you go up and you say, well, I really don't have much to offer you, and, you know, I'm not much of a man with words, and then go under the radar. And I think, you know, sometimes our own President Bush is able to do that. Or President Reagan was a great example of that, of somebody who came in kind of simple and folksy and then ended up saying things that, blew people away. And Paul can do that. I think as a preaching presence, I do think, you know, when Paul's physical presence may not have been that impressive. And I've heard the same thing about Luther, by the way, that his physical presence may not have been all that impressive, but certainly in his writing, very impressive. And I'm sure that when Paul, you know, when he got to, the Spirit moved him, so to speak, when he got worked up about something, I'm sure it must have been quite a sight.
Now, let's deal with Peter just a little bit more here. How is it that Peter, who has prominence among the disciples already during the earthly ministry of Jesus, and certainly prominence among the disciples, according to Luke's account, because it kind of follows Peter and everybody else kind of comes along for the ride until Paul shows up on the scene. How is it that Peter is not the first bishop in Jerusalem, but in fact James?
Yeah, that is, I mean, I am fascinated by that tale. My feeling is that Peter was in fact the leader in Jerusalem for a time. And I don't know, I think it was a significant amount of time. The council is in, 49? And, of course, Peter is speaking in Pentecost, let's say, in 33. I know the dates aren't exactly right, but that 16-year time period. My feeling is Peter was the bishop, I guess we would say, the leader, and that's evidence in the book of Acts. When Peter speaks, everybody listens, and then John is by his side. But as time went on, I think Peter also moved on. Whether he went to Antioch or I'm not sure, but when Peter did move on, and then James, I think, remained and ended up becoming the leader, and that you can see his leadership, of course, in Acts 15 when he's the one who makes the final decision about how to proceed in the presenting of the gospel to the Gentiles. But there, it is a wonderful picture that Luke paints because it's the ministry of Paul is in a sense on trial. Peter speaks up on Paul's defense, in Paul's behalf, and then James, the brother of our Lord, most probably stands up and makes the final decision. But remember, the whole book of Acts is really based on two figures. It's Peter for the first 12 chapters, and then Paul for the remaining chapters. And what Luke wants to show, because I think there were people who were already trying to divide Peter and Paul back then, and saying, oh, Paul doesn't belong, he's not a real apostle. What I think Luke wants to do is show that everything that Peter does, Paul does. And so Peter heals by whatever it is, a shadow. Paul heals by the cloak or vice versa. They both go to jail and the angel saves them both. Now these things are true and Luke wants to underline the truth of them. And their message is the same, Luke wants to show. And so that way, in a way, Luke is saying, yes, you can trust Paul because he is like Peter. And the funny thing is, in the book of Acts, it's Peter who's the first one who goes out to the Gentiles. It's Peter who meets Cornelius and has a vision before Paul does. Our Lord appears in a vision to Peter saying, you know, eat and don't declare anything unclean, which I have declared clean. So Peter is the one who paves the way for Paul's ministry. And it's Luke's way of showing that even though they appear in some ways to be very different, that there really is a continuum between them.
We've talked a bit about Peter here. Let's talk about Paul. Now, before Jesus calls Peter, we know virtually nothing of him, save that he was most likely a disciple of John the Baptist. But Paul has a real checkered past and a real history. And I heard someone once say that had Paul not met Christ on the Damascus Road, he may well have gone on to great fame in rabbinic history, given the fact that he came from, at least in his education, very good stock.
Well, he definitely was a genius. He had, I don't know, there are people who can look at writings, you know, try to figure out what the IQ of the person was. If you had to look at the IQ of Paul, and the sophistication of his arguments, which makes his reading sometimes very difficult to read. He can be very sweet, but sometimes difficult. You would have to say this guy's got the intellectual firepower, and I've never heard that before. I've never considered, you know, what he might have done in Judaism, but certainly he would have been a hero to those who dismissed the Jesus movement. And he was a person. He was a person who, I don't know whether it's the type A personality or whatever you might want to call it, but he kind of gets obsessed. He's obsessed first with, he's got a fervor of spirit. Intellectually, when Paul comes to an idea, he pursues it. So he sees first Jesus as an enemy. Well, a lot of people could see Jesus as an enemy and be apathetic and say, well, you know, that's not what I believe. Paul, though, sees Jesus as wrong and therefore as an enemy and therefore pursues the Christian church, persecutes the Christian church as an enemy to what he knows to be true or thinks he knows to be true. And then Jesus takes that same personality and that same drive and ambition and intellectual firepower, turns him around on the road to Damascus, so he sees Jesus in a new light, and all of a sudden all that energy is used for the sake of the kingdom of God. And then he becomes, you know, Paul is relentless, full of energy, and, you know, Paul says, one of the things he says about his apostleship, he goes, you know, I'm the least of all the apostles, I'm the last chosen, I was chosen out of time. But he also says, I worked harder than any of the other apostles. I think, you know, he has in his mind that he's making up for lost time. So for all the years of persecution, for all the time he was an enemy of Christ, he has that sense of eschatological or end times urgency that with every moment, with every waking breath he has, he wants to further the kingdom of God and tell others the good news about Jesus Christ. And that's, I mean, Paul is a very compelling figure in that way.
And for those, we talked about those who wanted then and today would want to drive a wedge between Peter and Paul. What about those today who would drive a wedge between Jesus and Paul, saying that Jesus had this very basic kind of moralism that he taught, and then Paul came along and modified Christianity, and he's the real inventor of Christianity?
Yeah, and this is unfortunate. It happens in any number of ways. It can happen even in Lutheran circles, I think, in some strange way. At least it seems for a long time, you go to a Lutheran church, and they would always be preaching on Paul as if Paul had the gospel, and then Jesus was good for the Sermon on the Mount kind of rules about the Christian life. But that's not the way to think about it. Paul is, for, in any teaching of the Christian faith, you got to begin with Jesus. He is foundational and he is fundamental. But again, I think Luke is the one who shows the continuity. I think that's why he wrote, we already have the Gospel of Matthew. I think Luke wanted to write a two-part work called Luke-Acts, or two volumes, however you want to say this, and he wanted to show the continuity that the same Jesus who taught Peter, so Jesus taught Peter and the 12 in the book of Luke, that same message now that is going to be preached to all nations is carried out in the book of Acts by Paul, by Peter, and by Paul, so that the message of, and then Paul says it himself in his letters, that he's finally determined to preach nothing. He's the most Christological preacher of all. He's determined to preach nothing but Christ and him crucified. The difference is Christ preaches himself, and Paul preaches Christ. So the subject is the same of both of their preaching. And it is a wonderful thing. Look at the beginning of almost any Pauline letter. I was just teaching 1 Corinthians this morning to a bunch of high school kids. And we counted up the number of times that Jesus Christ was mentioned in the first 10 verses. 10 times. So Paul is not a generic God teacher, but he is specifically moved by the work and message of Jesus Christ.
Dr. Scare, let's do this in 2 30-second little things, in fact, even shorter. What do we know about how Paul ended his ministry? What do we know about Peter ending their ministry? 30 seconds apiece.
Okay, I don't know if I'm going to put them in a piece or try to put them together in the sense that the traditions are, at least, that they both died a martyr's death, and they both died a martyr's death in Rome. Rome is considered to have the apostolic foundation of St. Peter and St. Paul. And it is thought that both died under the persecution of the emperor Nero. And Peter, and I don't know whether the legend or the stories are true, Peter being crucified on an upside-down cross, and what happened to Paul, but they're both thought to have died in the mid-60s because of persecution and because of they were martyred for their faith in Christ Jesus. So in that sense, at the fitting end, God brought them together in a way at the end, which is their ministry was truly together.
Dr. Peter Scare, thank you for being our guest. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks, Todd. Much appreciated myself.
Dr. Peter Scare is Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Can you imagine sitting in a classroom with a teacher like Dr. Peter Scare? Can you imagine that? I mean, concise and to the point, and talk about kind of a Pauline passion for bringing the message of Christ. Even as we talk about Christ's disciples, the cross shines through and through. Can you imagine getting this in a classroom? This is exactly the kind of instruction that you receive and that those who study for the pastoral ministry receive at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. So why not prayerfully consider a visit out to Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne? For more information, you can call them 1-800-481-2155. 1-800-481-2155. And really, Dr. Peter Scare is just the tip of the iceberg on their excellent faculty. 1-800-481-2155. Or go to our website and look for the picture of Kramer Chapel on our homepage, issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org. All right, when we come back from this break, I was intrigued. Oh, this was a couple days ago. My copy of National Geographic came in the mail, and I left it in the wrapper for a long, long time, and then I let it slide out, and I looked at this thing. Right there on the cover of National Geographic, stem cells. Then there's a big article inside there all about stem cells and all about how they work and the promise and everything, and it had a section. I was surprised to see a section on adult stem cells as well. Well, we're going to talk about stem cell research, religion, and science with Wesley Smith when we come back. I'll ask him first if he's seen that and what he wants to say about it, if anything. But he's also written recently on Mario Cuomo, former governor of New York, and his accusation against President Bush about religion, letting religion run his stem cell policy. We'll see what Wesley has to say about that after this.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
We've all heard about the unrest, atrocities, and persecution in the Sudan. Well, LCMS World Relief is on the front lines of providing comfort and hope through several projects. They're helping to provide emergency food for children in southern Sudan, school books and supplies, grinding mills for Sudanese in refugee camps, and enhancements to St. Paul Lutheran Medical Center in Khartoum. Now, for more information on how you can help support relief efforts in the Sudan, look for the LCMS World Relief logo on our homepage, issuesetc.org. Their phone number, 314-996-1683. Late last year, the Republic of Sudan and the Sudan People's Liberation Army reached a peace accord. Many Sudanese who fled their homes will be returning. You can help the resettlement and the education of these refugees by supporting LCMS World Relief. Issuesetc.org or 314-996-1683. LCMS World Relief.
Evolution. It's really sun worship.
Answers with Ken Ham
author of the wonderful children's book, D is for Dinosaur. Well, Ken, I know that pagan cultures, like the ancient Egyptians, worshiped the sun, but isn't evolution really just about life evolving?
Well, you know, evolution involves much more than life arising from non-life by natural means. You see, evolution really does away with God, and it allows people to explain their existence without any supernatural being involved. In fact, evolution is a whole philosophy of life. It teaches that man by himself can determine truth, that there's no God. In other words, they believe that life can be explained solely on the basis of what they're seeing acting around them today. In essence, that is their religion. Part of the evolutionist religion is that the energy from the sun, acting on some primeval soup millions of years ago, caused the first life forms to emerge. Thus, they believe that the sun really gave birth to living things. They're actually giving glory to the sun's energy for life. You know, down through the ages, culture after culture has worshipped the sun. If you recall, the Israelites were warned not to worship the sun as the pagan nations did around them. Scientists may claim that evolution has nothing to do with religion, but it's their religion to worship creation instead of the Creator.
Why is America and some other Western nations becoming more pagan? How has the creation-evolution controversy played a role? Read Ken Ham's new booklet, free on our website, AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. The latest brain research shows that the front part of the brain is responsible for self-control and moral judgment. This part of the brain develops through childhood and adolescence. The American Academy of Pediatrics reports some research has suggested that mindless television may idle this particular part of the brain and impoverish its development. So how much TV can our children watch? Again, the American Academy of Pediatrics says 1 hour a day is a lot for preschoolers, and 1 to 2 hours is the maximum for older children. Motivated by God's love, which He has shown us in Jesus, we can place limits on our children and their TV time. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
AMA 50 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, with a showroom in the Mid-County Trade Center, 8463 Delport Drive. Reliable Heating and Cooling features Lennox air conditioning and furnace systems and services all brands. Reliable also provides senior discounts. Reliable Heating and Cooling, serving you from North, Mid, and West County exchanges. The next time you call Reliable at 423-3535, please thank them for being an AMA 50 KFUO underwriter.
Welcome back to the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Wesley Smith is our guest during these few final moments. We're going to be talking about religion, science, and stem cell research. Wesley is a regular guest. He's senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, author of several books, including his latest, Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. I highly recommend this book, by the way. And he's also written a column for the Weekly Standard titled Stem Cell Sleight of Hand, about Mario Cuomo, former governor of New York, and what he's been saying lately about the Bush policy on stem cell research, and he thinks that religion is playing a hand to the detriment of real science. We'll see what Wesley has to say. Wesley, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
Now, I understand, I was just mentioning to the listeners before you came on that I got my copy of National Geographic, and I know you haven't had a chance to look at your copy of it, but the cover story is stem cell research, and I found the article to be probably informative, but nothing new as to what we're seeing in the press about stem cell research. And one gets very discouraged. You can't see these things. They're invisible to the naked eye. The press is almost all in favor of going ahead with stem cell research. If you stand against public funding for it, like George W. Bush, you will catch fire from every direction. And one wonders sometimes whether or not we should even be fighting this fight. How do you respond?
Well, I could give a Bronx cheer to that last statement. Huh. I mean, we're to do what's right regardless of whether we can win or not, and advocate for what's right. But I do think we can win. We have to consider that the media is definitely biased in this field of endeavor, that many of the science reporters who write on these issues think of themselves almost as boosters as opposed to objective reporters. Many of the reporters who go to report on these issues are ignorant, and it's not a matter of bias, but they just don't know the issue. So they'll go to somebody like me, and they'll say, well, what do you think about XYZ? And I'll say, well, look at those adult stem cell research and how they're really advancing. Then they'll go to some high PhD who'll say, well, adult stem cell research doesn't have the potential, and we need to do the embryonic. And these are just, you know, average field reporters, and they don't know, so they think, well, the PhD's objective because he's a scientist, and Wesley's an advocate, without realizing that the PhD not only is not objective, not only is as biased as I am and as ideological as I might be, but also may have a financial conflict of interest that was not disclosed to the reporter. So what we need to do is look at media bias or media ignorance as a rocket scientist does gravity. It's a fact of life, but that doesn't mean we can't get the rocket into space.
Now, Mario Cuomo, you've written about something about Mario Cuomo recently for the Weekly Standard, Wesley, famous as a former governor of New York. When he wrote this thing back in June in the New York Times, Not on Faith Alone, about George W. Bush and his stem cell policy, this thing started on fire. I probably got 20 emails with people linking me to this thing. What did Cuomo have to say? What is his criticism of George W. Bush's stem cell policy?
Well, you know, it's really disappointing that the New York Times and that Mario Cuomo, who's certainly one of the most prominent Americans around, would print and or write an article of this kind, because, you know, you can disagree with George Bush's embryonic stem cell funding policy and realize it does not ban embryonic stem cell research. And secondly, it has nothing to do with cloning. So you'll often hear people saying, well, look at what the South Koreans have done, and that's because Bush had this restriction on embryonic stem cell research. Well, that's mixing apples and oranges, because Bush's funding issue refers to whether or not federal money can be used to destroy embryos left over from fertilization treatments, IVF embryos. And what happened in South Korea was human cloning. Those were different things, but you'll often see advocates confuse things, because the advocates, instead of calling cloning cloning, now call it embryonic stem cell research, and also call using the research from leftover embryos embryonic stem cell research, with malice aforethought to confuse the American people and make people not understand that what's really going on and the real agenda here is human cloning. But what Mario Cuomo did was he basically said, George Bush thinks that, you know, destroying these embryos is akin to murder. George Bush has never said that. I did research. I looked into it. I called the White House. He has never said it's murder. And the fact that Cuomo didn't put quote marks around the term doesn't excuse him. That sets up a straw man so that he could then say, well, if George Bush thinks it's murder, why doesn't he try to ban the murder of embryos during fertilization treatments? That's a way of not arguing the facts. And he also said that this was just a matter of imposing religion. Well, guess what? As I pointed out in my article in response to Cuomo, which was published in the Daily Standard, federal policy of preventing funding of medical research that destroys embryos precedes George Bush's presidency. It's called the Dickey Amendment. It came about in 1996. It was signed by Bill Clinton every year that he was president until George Bush took over, and it puts the federal government firmly in stating, and this was bipartisan, it wasn't just pro-lifers, and it wasn't just Republicans, but the federal government firmly on record as stating, we will not finance the destruction of human embryos in medical research. It doesn't mean you can't do it. It just means taxpayer money won't be used for it, because many Americans are opposed morally to that type of behavior or that type of research. So Mario Cuomo just did a piece of demagoguery, and the New York Times did no fact-checking. And I know what it's like to be published in the New York Times. When I had my piece in the Times, which was about Jack Kevorkian, I could use a crude metaphor, but I'll tell you, the fact-checking went on for more than a week, and I had to justify every single sentence that I wrote, and if I said that Kevorkian said something, I had to prove it to the editors of the New York Times. Cuomo could never prove to the New York Times that George Bush called embryonic stem cell research murder because he's never done it.
And yet Cuomo is, in his own way, quite persuasive. And he also appeals to a certain segment. That is, you know, he's Roman Catholic, so apparently he can speak to this religion issue, but he's pro-choice. And yet he claims to be against abortion, just he has a longer-term solution for the whole thing. So what do we do with those people who find, what do those people who find Cuomo's argument here persuasive in that category? What do they need to know about the holes in Cuomo's argument?
Well, first off, that Cuomo's the one who's not spouting appropriate science. I, as you saw from my piece, I decided, well, let's go see when human life does begin biologically. That is a science question. That is something that can be answered very easily, because Mario Cuomo said that Bush's religion made him believe that life began at fertilization. Actually, what makes Bush believe life begins at fertilization, human life, is science, embryology, basic embryology. I went to embryology textbooks, and lo and behold, every single one of them that I looked at, and I quoted a couple of them, said the biological fact that a human, new human individual organism, or a new human individual life, or some even use the term human being, begins at the completion of fertilization. That's basic biology. The fact that Mario Cuomo says it's not human life is anti-science, if you will, because it's junk science would be a better term. Moreover, he began to try to define human life as being conscious or having some other attributes, but that's not the definition of human life. Human life is a biological concept, which biologically begins at the point of end of conception, or the point of fertilization's being completed. And it also begins, since we've learned as human beings how to create human life asexually, that is through cloning, upon the completion of the somatic cell nuclear transplant, the cloning process, when a new cloned human embryo comes into being. So that's the science of it. Now, morally and ethically, we can then decide, does that matter or does that not matter? But one cannot say that biologically or scientifically, human life doesn't begin at fertilization, because when else would it begin?
So the charge, the religion card, so to speak, that's being played here is not being fairly played on the part of Cuomo. Why do you think that argument, though, has so much traction with the American public?
I don't know that it does have a lot of traction with the American public. It has a lot of traction with the scientific community, which tends to, in some regards, at least let's not say the scientists, but among the leaders of the scientific establishment. I think that's a better term, because many scientists I've seen polls are religious. But the establishment, the leadership of the science community, the leadership of the bioethics community, either has disdain for religion altogether, or at the very least believes that religion should not have any place in deciding these kinds of moral and ethical issues, that it's somehow extraneous, it's something apart from their, you know, their rational determinations. Well, that's baloney, because whether one is dealing with philosophy, as in bioethics, say utilitarianism, or whether one is dealing with religion, you find out what are your first principles, what are the core beliefs that you have. And these core beliefs are not necessarily things that can be measured or proven. You cannot prove, for example, that a human life has moral meaning when it's a week old, or whether it doesn't have moral meaning. That is not something that is subject to testing. That comes from values. That comes from religion. That comes from philosophy. That comes from beliefs. And that intrinsically is subjective. And the American people, and including, I think, most scientists, believe that human life matters simply and merely because it's human. Now, most people, I would agree, would not think that a one-week-old embryo is the same thing as a two-year-old child, but that doesn't mean it's chopped liver either.
To your knowledge, was then-President Bill Clinton ever accused of imposing his subjective religious beliefs on the rest of us and undoing science in the process when he put his signature on the Dickey Amendment?
What do you think? Of course not.
I think they call that asked and answered, probably.
Yeah, but realize that Bill Clinton also, as soon as the embryonic stem cell research began, which was 1998, using human embryos, was trying to find a way around the Dickey Amendment. He didn't have the guts, if you will, political guts, to try to destroy the Dickey Amendment or to set it aside or to have Congress not pass it. So he looked for a way around it. And toward the very end of his administration, Bill Clinton came up with his funding policy, which was very Clinton-esque in its approach, and it basically said, we will not allow federal money to be used to destroy the embryos, nor will we allow federal money to be used to set up the embryonic stem cell lines, that is, starting it so that there are lines of cells in a dish that keep replicating. However, once that has been done, we will have federal money permitted to fund research thereafter. Therefore, what Clinton was saying was, even though we can't give you the money to do the actual destroying of the embryos, you destroy the embryos in anticipation of receiving federal money, and it's okay. That was certainly against the spirit of the Dickey Amendment. George Bush, who ran against federal funding of embryonic stem cell research in 2000, suspended that policy as soon as he got into office and then went into that 6 month of contemplation about what to do, which ended up with his so-called compromise, in which he said, and remember, this is not about cloning. This is about using embryos left over from fertilization treatments that were going to be supposedly tossed out anyway. Remember, that is the only way you can really get the American people to support the research in terms of polls, because they think these embryos are going to be destroyed anyway, so you might as well get some good out of them. That has nothing to do with creating embryos for use in research, which is what therapeutic cloning does, or doing it with fertilization, which the National Academy of Sciences has now come out in favor of. But this was just that one limited area, and he said, no, we're not going to do that either. We're only going to federally fund embryonic stem cell research on lines already in existence as of August 9th, 2001, on the belief that this was already, you know, these lines were not created in anticipation of federal money, and that no federal money would be used to destroy further embryos in furtherance of this policy. And in furtherance of that policy, in 2003, about $25 million of federal money was spent on embryonic stem cell research.
Now, another thing I've been reading a lot in the press when it comes to President Bush and his policy on embryonic stem cell research, all the way back to that August 2001 decision that he took, that you've talked about here, is that, well, the president promised a certain number of stem cell lines, but most of them turned out to be junk and not usable, and now we're down to like 20. And the numbers always vary in the various accounts, but you hear the researchers saying, you know, almost implying that the president broke his promise by not providing the number that were supposedly available when he did permit that limited federal funding for those lines.
Well, there are still thousands of samples left frozen that could be used at the NIH, and none of these supposed reason they're corrupted is that they've been maintained on animal, what are called animal feeder cells, and so they're saying these can't be used in people. Well, of course they can't. The research is so rudimentary, you can't use embryonic stem cells in people. Moreover, in animal studies, they cause tumors, so it wouldn't be safe. But, Todd, I really want to make this point and really emphasize that all of this talk about Bush's funding policy and the idea of whether or not the federal government should fund embryonic stem cell research with leftover IVF embryos is a diversion. It is to divert attention away from where the real action is. It's an almost obsolete discussion. It's not obsolete, but it's getting there, because the scientists are now very excited, and what they really want to do is research from cloned embryos, the South Korean model. That's what Proposition 71 in California is about. That's what the law in New Jersey now permits. Plus, New Jersey permits clone fetal farming by permitting cloning implantation and gestation through the ninth month. There are animal experiments using cloned fetuses to derive medical benefits that would be legal in humans in New Jersey. There have been other states such as Washington State, Minnesota, Texas, Maryland, Delaware, Illinois, that have had proposals that came very close to passing that would have permitted clone fetal farming, cloning through the ninth month. The efficiency for creating embryonic stem cell lines is greater, apparently, through cloning than it is using frozen embryos, because the frozen embryos apparently have some damage from the freezing process. So this whole idea of Bush's funding policy is to take people's attention and the media's attention away from the real action, and also is designed to confuse people as to what is being discussed, as I said before, because they'll call what occurred, the cloning in South Korea, embryonic stem cell research when it's cloning, and they will also call the embryonic stem cell research funding issue embryonic stem cell research to try to confuse the two, because if people know it's cloning, they oppose it, and they tend to support using leftover embryos that are going to be tossed out anyway.
And do you think legislatively there's something sitting in the agenda of the Washington lawmakers to deal with that issue before someone starts suddenly saying, hey, this is kind of an area where no one said we can, no one said we can't, let's get to it?
Well, that's the state we find ourselves in, and the reason we find ourselves in that state is that the attempt to outlaw all human cloning, which has passed the House twice in a strong bipartisan vote, along with pro-lifers and pro-choicers voting in favor of the total cloning ban, is hooked up in the Senate. The Brownback Landrieu bill, which would outlaw all human cloning in the United States, is blocked by a filibuster. And they cannot get the 60 votes to invoke cloture, and therefore we have no federal policy on human cloning. 7 states, however, have outlawed all human cloning, the most recent being Indiana this year. Texas tried, and I testified in favor of the Texas bill, and the junk science from the scientists who came to testify against that bill, and frankly, flat-out lies, told the legislators scientifically, scientific lies or junk biology, was just enough to make me believe that there's a complete disdain for democracy among some of the biotech advocates, because they won't be honest with the American people about what it is we're talking about, thereby preventing us from having a real moral debate, which is what is required on these issues. Not only that, but now you've got some scientists, for example, one fellow out here in Stanford University says he's going to make a mouse with a human brain, and no one can stop him. And so we find ourselves at an impasse. And yet, if it's only religion that is opposing to human cloning, then how can we explain that the United Nations General Assembly, not exactly a theocracy, voted by about a 3-to-1 margin to urge member states to outlaw all human cloning? France, not exactly a Taliban country, the most secular free nation on earth, voted to outlaw all human cloning about a year or two ago. Canada, which is San Francisco as a country, has outlawed all human cloning. Norway has outlawed all human cloning. Australia has outlawed all human cloning. Germany doesn't allow any cloning or any embryonic stem cell research or any research that destroys embryos. And Germany is a secular nation as well. So this idea peddled by Mario Cuomo that it's only religion, as opposed to ethics, values, morals, and philosophy, and common sense, that has us opposing human cloning is demagoguery, pure and simple, and is designed not to have a debate rather than to engage in a respectful, reasonable debate in which accurate facts are presented so that the American people can decide. It is a contempt. It's contemptuous of democracy, in my view.
Wesley, in the last few minutes here, I don't think we've had an opportunity since the autopsy results for Terry Schindler-Shivo were made public to get your reaction to those things and your thoughts on those things here on the program, your thoughts on the autopsy results and how they were generally portrayed in the press.
Well, the media portrayed it as somehow some great vindication for Michael Schivo, which was ludicrous. The autopsy results did not tell us anything we didn't already know, that Terry Schivo was a profoundly cognitively disabled young woman who was not going to become a cheerleader, if you will. But the reason people stood up for Terry's life wasn't because she was going to get better or not get better, and we still don't know whether she might have been able to be improved, because the autopsy couldn't tell us whether or not she was actually in a persistent vegetative state. It said that her brain injuries were consistent with that diagnosis, but it would also be consistent with a person who has profound cognitive disability and some ability to interact. It really doesn't matter. And what's a little disheartening is that some people who are on the defend Terry life feel that they have to get into the autopsy and start rebutting it, and as if to say that, well, there has to be a reason to defend Terry. Terry was an equal human being who was as much worthy of love, attention, and proper care when she was disabled as she was the day before she collapsed. That's the point we have to make. That's the point the parents consistently made, the Schindlers. And the idea of dehydrating her to death because of her disability, and that's what happened, is inhumane and should not be permitted. We're already beginning to see some new kinds of, quote, Terry's laws. One just passed in Louisiana, for example, that makes it so that if somebody has a conflict of interest, such as Michael Schiavo had, in this situation where he's living with another woman and having children by her and then still claiming to be the loving husband when he's actually abandoned that relationship, well, in Louisiana now, that person would not be able to make such a decision. I think that states and the federal government need to pass laws that say that food and fluids provided through a tube is going to be treated differently than other forms of care, because if you take it away, it has one result, and the symbolism of saying you do not have a life worth living to the point where we're not even going to feed you or give you water is so profound and sends such an insidious anti-disability message that I think we need to take action in that regard. So my message on my blog and in my articles it now is, you know, we can't keep sifting through these ashes. We can't keep going back and, well, how long did it take him to call 911? The issue is over. People think what they think about Terry Schiavo. No one's mind is going to be changed at this point, but we can use the tragedy and the profound injustice that she suffered and use it as a motivating, positive motivating force to protect others from having this done to them, because people like Terry and people who are much more cognitive are being dehydrated to death as we speak in all 50 states.
Wesley Smith is our guest. You'll find the best and latest information on issues bioethical on the web at WesleyJSmith.com, WesleyJSmith.com, including the column we discussed today, Stem Cell Sleight of Hand, WesleyJSmith.com. Wesley, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you.
Wesley is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, author of several books, including his latest, I recommend it, called Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World, and he's also written a column for the Weekly Standard titled Stem Cell Sleight of Hand. That website address again, WesleyJSmith.com, WesleyJSmith.com. Tomorrow on the program, well, we've talked a little bit today about Billy Graham, a lot of information shared back and forth between you and me on that subject already today and earlier this week. Tomorrow, we'll review Billy Graham's sermon last Sunday during his New York crusade. We have the audio, and we'll do a second sermon review this week here on Issues Etc. Billy Graham himself, tomorrow on the program. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.